Welcome to Special Sauce, Sirius XM's podcast about food and life. Every week on Special Sauce, we talk to some of the leading lights of American culture, food folks and non-food folks alike. How many cats do you have?
Three, yeah.
What are their names?
Nampul, Yindi, and Jamuk.
Those are my cat's names.
Get out of here. You've got a cat named Crab Paste, Welcome, and Nose.
Yes.
That's amazing.
Today's chef and restaurateur, Andy Ricker, is back with us. He has introduced many Americans, including me, to the joys and pleasures of Northern Thai food in his restaurants, Pak Pak, in Portland and Brooklyn. The restaurant is happening. You start to open other restaurants in Portland. I assume you start writing this book. So there's a lot of success happening after a lot of years of struggle. Talk about how you dealt with that.
Well, I think the way I dealt with it was that I was just working so much and I had my head stuffed so far up my own ass that I just wasn't really able to countenance everything that was happening around me, because you don't – like when you're running a restaurant, you don't really get it to stop and kind of go, oh, well, look at me. I'm doing awesome. You're like the dishwasher's broken. Or the person who operates the dishwashing machine doesn't show up for work. You know, there's just so many things that are happening. You know, you're having problems with deliveries. You're going to get the food. You're cooking. You're doing all this stuff. You're opening a new restaurant. You're dealing with running one restaurant, doing another one. That stuff just takes your whole day up. You don't have time to kind of go, wow, I'm really successful, and there's a lot of pressure around it.
And did you ever think about having a partner?
Early on, I really didn't want to, because somebody would be there, you know, having a different
opinion.
Than right. Me. And I'm a Capricorn, and, you know, I wanted to do what I wanted to do. I wasn't really interested in what somebody else wanted to do. And I had a really specific idea of what I wanted to do. And I don't know a whole lot of people who kind of have exactly the same experience and the same outlook.
Yeah.
And so I just really, you know, that I didn't want that complication. I did have, early on I had a guy who kind of came on board, and we were partners at Whiskey Soda Lounge, but that didn't last.
Is your bar in Portland?
Right. I bought him out. We had started a burger bar. He bought me out, or vice versa. I bought him out of Whiskey Soda Lounge. He bought me out of the burger joint. Now I think about it and be like, it would be great to have somebody else who kind of was in lockstep with what I wanted to do.
Right.
Who was a partner. But it just hasn't happened. I still, to this day, I don't have partners.
And then you wrote the book.
Yeah, the book happened. That was interesting. I really never thought about writing a book. But then I got a few different people kind of saying, hey, you should write a book.
Right.
And they were writers, you know, co-writers. Like, you should write a book. And I ended up meeting J.J.
Yeah, who's a friend of mine, a wonderful writer.
Amazing guy. This was early on in his now incredibly successful cookbook
writing. J.J. Good, the best one-armed food writer in the world.
And I would just say take the one-armed part out of it and just say
one of the best
food writers in the world.
I agree.
J.J.'s done a lot of great stuff, you know, April Bloomfield.
Yeah.
Loads of different people that he's worked with, and he's just did his own thing.
And he captured your voice perfectly, I have to say.
Yeah, we work really well together. You know, there's conflict, of course.
Sure. That's built in. I've written a couple of those.
Yeah.
I understand that. But there were so many things when I reread the book this past week that stuck out. You say, I'm not a chef. I didn't invent this stuff. The food at my restaurants is not my take on Thai food.
Mm-hmm.
What did you mean by that?
The approach of most chefs is to go and study a food, usually in a relatively cursory manner these days, and then kind of absorb some of the techniques and the flavors and stuff and try to recreate it in their own image somehow. And for me, the food that I was encountering there didn't need any help. It didn't need my touch. Like, I didn't really have anything to offer to it. Aside from a few, like, you know, I'd say the one way that I've tried to kind of form it a little bit is to be a little careful about the technique with which we execute things. It's a big enough job just to take that food and make it something that you can repeat over and over again in a restaurant in the United States with health, labor,
sure,
all that kind of laws. The food really didn't need anything else.
Right.
As good as it was.
It didn't need your take on it.
No, it just needed, I felt it was necessary to bring it what I had seen in Thailand and tasted, traveling.
You wanted to spread the gospel of Thai food and culture.
Right. And basically to me, for a long time, this is changing now, which is great. But Thai food was kind of relegated to this kind of, commodity, giant portions, enough food to take home after a meal for cheap. And to me, the food of Thailand is so much more than that,
Yeah. And you're traveling, you're going to a lot of outdoor restaurants. And did you end up asking just tons of questions?
Yeah. So the genesis of it was that I would go and my friends would show me this stuff. And I decided that in order to learn more, I'd have to learn some of the language. So I started, I started learning the language. I started learning more and more about what went into the food. I'd ask lots of questions to my friends. Eventually, I got to the point where I could speak Thai well enough that I could talk to other people about it. And, I just developed a palate and I developed kind of an understanding of the ingredients and the culture. And that's, that's what led me to where I am now. It's just this slowly, over 13 years or so, just kind of slowly gaining more and more knowledge, going and cooking with friends, going observing other cooks in the markets and restaurants cooking, just kind of trying to pick up as much as I could and practicing it.
One of the things that I want to ask you about is how did you go about translating the food that you experienced in Thailand here, given the, there are some ingredients that you just can't get. Mm. So how did you deal with that?
Well, initially, the way I dealt with it is just not put anything on the menu that I couldn't get the ingredients for. That was the most obvious thing to do. Like if you can't get, young jackfruit, you can't make tambanun, right? You just can't do it. So you don't put it on the menu. If you're forced to use like a vastly inferior product in order to achieve a recipe, also no go. So that was the first thing. Second thing was that, I would bring back certain hard to find ingredients from Thailand so that I could execute. And now it's, depending on where you live, it's getting easier and easier to get a hold of stuff. For instance, there's a Thai farming community in Florida.
Right.
That have finally, they're producing all these ingredients that Thai people use. Whereas initially, probably they were just growing stuff that
You could probably buy them online.
And in Fresno, there's a Hmong farmer population.
In Minneapolis, there's a Hmong farmer population.
Right, but Fresno is like
exactly. That's
right
year round. Yeah, right. Yeah. That's 10-month growing seasons.
And they're growing things that like for the market commodity stuff, arugula, basil, that kind of stuff. But they also have their own stuff that they grow for themselves. And that's slowly starting to hit the market too. So
cool. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So the second disclaimer in the book is I'm not a trained scholar of Thai food or Thai culture. My knowledge is largely anecdotal. Mm-hmm. So it's almost like you were taking an oral history of Thai food and Thai culture.
Yeah. And it's ongoing. That'll be till the day I die, probably. Yeah.
And you leave the scholarship to scholars.
Yeah, there's some folks out there, these days who are like Leela from She Simmers. She's a real, Thai food scholar. David Thompson, Thai food scholar. There's other folks in Thailand, Thai folks who are Thai food scholars. I'm not one of them.
It's okay.
I do try to be respectful and really try to understand stuff. I think that's really important.
Sure.
It's for me, being a Westerner cooking this food, I feel okay about doing that. I've been doing it for a very long time. But there is a lot of cultural appropriation that does happen. And I've been accused of it. I understand why. And to a certain degree, I agree with it, But it's no more, I don't believe it's any more than an American going and learning French food.
Or Italian
or
food.
Or Italian food. Or Spanish
we had
food
Mark Ladner on.
Amazing Mark
right,
Ladner.
Amazing Italian chef. But I don't believe he has any Italian blood.
Yeah, I don't. I've never asked him if he does or not.
Yeah, and yet nobody attacks him, and so it seems like cultural appropriation accusations relate more to cultures like Asian culture. Like, nobody would, as you just said, nobody would say that about a guy from Brooklyn who masters French food.
True, but you got to understand that you know, Asian culture has been appropriated massively in this country, and it's you know, the Asian food has been the subject of you know, ridicule in the past by Westerners. Now now it's not. So look, I totally get that. I totally agree that's an issue. And the best way that I can answer that for myself is just say, look, I do my best to be very, very respectful and not make any claims of authenticity or ownership or anything like that. Just, you know, say, hey, I'm just making this thing that I learned how to make, and, you know, I've worked really hard to make it really good, and I want to be respectful about it.
You told Francis Lam, as you said, you have mixed feelings sort of about being cast as an emissary for Thai food.
Yeah.
You said, I'd be happy if someone called me that honestly, but I would never make that claim myself because in Thai society, a foreigner representing them doesn't make sense.
No, I mean, really, it's like if you're Thai, the prevailing idea is that Westerners can't understand Thai food and culture because they're not Thai. That's part of Thai-ness, right? And to a certain extent, it's really true. It's like if you're born into a culture and you develop an inherent taste and understanding of the cuisine, that's something that you can't just acquire, right? It's a birthright. And I don't have that birthright.
Right. It's somewhat ironic, right, that the same year you won for Best Chef Northwest, Saipan Chutima won for Best Chef Southwest for her Thai restaurant, Lotus of Siam, and she was Thai.
Yeah, which is fantastic. And I, you know, I love Saipan, and Lotus of Siam is an incredibly important restaurant. And like, basically, I can tell you that it was the inspiration for opening Pok Pok for me.
Really?
One of the inspirations, yeah, for sure. I went to my girlfriend's house at the time, back in the, you know, late 90s, I think it was, early 2000s, and there was a food rag, some magazine that was actually a subscription to a friend of mine who lived down the street. And I was like, hey, how did Patrick's Bon Appetit end up here?
Right.
And so I picked it up and I was like, well, I'm just going to steal it and I'll give it back to him later. So I started reading it, and there was a little article about this restaurant, Lotus of Siam in Las Vegas, that had a secret Northern Thai menu. And I saw the menu. I was like, oh my God, this is the stuff that I've been going and eating in
right.
Chiang Mai. And I've never seen it on any menus here. And I was like, this is amazing that a place that a Thai woman in Las Vegas is making this stuff, and it's getting the attention of, you know, food rags. That means that there are people out there in America who are interested in this stuff, right? And that kind of helped me to think, well, maybe, you know, making a restaurant that does this kind of food would be viable and a good thing.
Yeah. You know you talk about in the book your Thai crew, which really helped you understand Thai food better. So talk a little bit about Sunny and Da Cham and Mr. Lit and Ajahn Suni. And
sure. So my good friend Chris that I told you about was married to a woman named Lakana. They were the ones who introduced me to the food early on. They had a network of friends, mostly folks that worked at the university. Khun Suni is an Ajahn or professor at Chiang Mai University of what amounts to home economics. So she teaches cooking to these students. And she took me under her wing and taught me a bunch of stuff. Sonny is a fantastic home cook. He's never worked in a restaurant, but he's always made food and sold it kind of on the side. Thai people often have a side gig going, you know, way to make money. He was also well-traveled, sophisticated, and, you know, like, believe me when I said, look, you know, I really want to learn this stuff. And he didn't try to polish it. Just
right.
kind of said, here's what I know. Mm-hmm. And from there, his family, his sisters, who to this day, my house in Chiang Mai is like 1 kilometer away from his older sister's house. She's, you know, see her all the time. Great cooks. I ended up going to SP Chicken in Chiang Mai a lot.
That's Mr. Lee's
Mr.
place.
Mr. Lit. Khun Lit. And he, you know, I'd go there and I'd see this guy out there roasting chickens, and eventually, you know, I decided that was what we wanted to do at Pok Pok to open, was to have a chicken rotisserie. So I went to him and said, hey, I'm going to do this. You know, would you be willing to tell me where to get these machines? So he said, and he you know, I was speaking to him in Thai, and he like pulled his mask off and spoke back to me in perfect English. And which was, you know, a little bit surprising. And we've become really good friends since then. And I just, you know, I have to say something about Mr. Litt and what he's done. He started out as a salesman for a chicken company. And he decided he wanted to do like roasted chicken. So he just pulled the drain out of the wall and opened a chicken shack. That it took him two and a half to 3 years to perfect his chickens. And then he did it for himself for 35 years.
Wow.
And then he turned it over to his daughter and son-in-law and wife, and they've been doing it for a further 8 or 10 years since then. And he's retired, and they're still making the same damn menu.
But I so want that chicken after reading about it in your book.
It's great, and it's the same. And to me, a lot of the food that we do at Pock Pock, and we write about in the book, is about vendors or people who specialize in one thing or a few specific things. And they just do that over and over and over again without really kind of thinking, well, I'm going to expand and do a hamburger joint.
Right.
Right?
Right.
I'm going to do lob.
Yeah.
And that's it. And
yeah.
I have so much more respect for that approach to cooking than I do to people who just have to change the menu every week.
It's very old-fashioned, right? Yeah. And sort of harkens back to the days of like André Sultan or Lutèce having one restaurant and living above the store, and that was his life.
Yes.
And people have moved away from that here, at least.
Yeah. Myself included. And part of me wishes that I never had. Part of me wishes that I had just said, look it, you know, screw all this other crap. I'm just going to concentrate on Pock Pock, and that's what I do. And, you know, in a lot of ways, that would have been just as rewarding. You know, things went a different way.
Before we go on, today's sponsor is Audible, a really cool app that offers an unmatched selection of audiobooks, original audio shows, news, comedy, and more from leading audiobook publishers, broadcasters, entertainers, magazine and newspaper publishers, and business information providers. They are now offering Special Sauce listeners, that's all of you, a free audiobook with a 30-day trial membership. Just go to audible.com/SeriousEats and browse the selection. Then download a title, free, and start listening. It's that easy. Go to audible.com/SeriousEats. That's audible.com/SeriousEats and get started today. We're talking with chef restaurateur Andy Ricker. So last week you were telling us that Pock Pock opened as a takeout joint, and then it became a sit-down restaurant in the same location?
Yeah, essentially there is a house, and in the basement was a little commercial kitchen. And then next to it is a little shack, and that was the old sushi retail thing. And I'd converted that into, you know, food, like a you know, it had a hand sink, and I could, you know, actually serve food out of it. So it started out with that. And meantime, I was building the house itself into a proper restaurant. I built a proper commercial kitchen upstairs. I converted the basement into a dining room and bar, bathrooms and stuff like that, and eventually the upstairs front bedroom into a dining room. So while that was happening, we were just doing we had to cut a couple tables in a little salon place and stuff like that. So we did that for like a year, and then got to the place where it's like, okay, now we can open the full service restaurant with a liquor license and all that.
You were doing
kind of
enough business. You didn't have to go into hock.
Well,
Still had to go into hock.
Still had to go into hock.
Less hock.
We had to replace the roof, you know, that kind of stuff. do a bunch of structural engineering and stuff like that. But, you know, and that was the lead up to me being broke, right? You know, there was money coming in. It was enough to pay the mortgage. But it wasn't enough to do all these improvements.
Right.
Right. So that was what was happening that whole time.
And what's funny is, and we were talking the other night about this, is that same sort of logistical issue comes up time and time again in a chef restaurateur's life. Like you were telling me about why you closed the wing joint in Brooklyn, you know, and it came down to logistics.
Yeah. As we said before, the restaurant industry is fraught with difficulties and pitfalls and objects. Basically, you spend your whole time solving problems. That's what it is. From the outside, it's hard to tell what's going on. You'll see a restaurant that's like supposedly very, very successful to the eye suddenly close. And it seems mysterious. Like, or you'll see a restaurant that appears to be doing really bad survive.
Right.
And it's, you know, it's hard to know because there's so many things happening behind the scene that you have no idea about.
Right? Yeah. You've closed the Pock Pock cooks in LA.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And some of that was logistical or?
I made a mistake opening where I did when I did at the size, you know, restaurant that we did. That was a mistake, you know, and, you know, I've been lucky enough to be relatively successful in most things that I've done. This is the first catastrophic that was stupid failure sort of thing.
And was it the wrong place at the wrong time?
Partially. It was, I assume, big. It was big. It was two floors. You could seat like 200 and something people.
Whoa.
The rent was really low, but, you know, it's still, you know, 6,000, 7,000 square feet. So even if you have a $2 square foot rent.
It's still significant.
And, you know, our execution wasn't where it should be. You know, just the whole thing was really, like, staffing was really difficult. The economics of running a restaurant in Chinatown in L.A., you know, it doesn't jibe if you're selling, you know, whole roasted chicken for $22 because you can go down the street and get a half a chicken for $7.
Got it.
Doesn't matter that we're using, you know, Mary's air-cooled natural chickens.
Right.
And that we're paying people a living wage. And,
right.
You know, all that kind of stuff.
It
doesn't matter because consumers will look at it and go, okay, you know, I can go down the street and get half a chicken for $7. So why would I go here?
Yeah.
So it was a number of things. It was poor execution on our side coming out of the gate. It was, you know, in a neighborhood that rolled the sidewalks up at 7 o'clock at night on the weekdays. But if I had to do it over again, one of two things would have happened. I wouldn't have done it, or I would have done exactly the same thing because I loved that neighborhood. I loved Chinatown. I've never opened in a restaurant in a place where I was like, I hate this neighborhood. I never want to go here or live here or be around here, but I'm going to open a restaurant here because I can make money.
So, a business like yours or mine at Serious Eats that's passion-driven is always going to be about the collision of heart and head and art and commerce.
Exactly, yeah. And I, you know, my – in this case, my heart outweighed the commerce part of it and the business sense. And it's too bad, but it's going to allow me to focus on the things that I know are in better in my wheelhouse. I didn't understand the LA market well enough either.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it was like in Thai we call jairon, which means hot-hearted. I went at it, you know, hammer and tongs without really doing enough research on it.
I like that. Jairon?
Jairon, yeah. Ron means hot. Jai is your hot. Ron is the hot.
And how did you come to open in Brooklyn after being in Portland?
So the James Beard Award thing happened and, you know, honestly, I didn't even know that there was such a thing as a James Beard Award. I got nominated one year, the year before I won, and they were like, hey, you just got nominated for a James Beard Award. I was like, great, what's that? And, you know, and then I kind of looked into it. I said, oh, but this is, you know, this is cool. And, you know, lo and behold, I got nominated again, and then I won, which was a massive shock to me. But that, you know, honestly, that's what opened the doors. You know, at that time, it was 10 years ago now, right? Something like that. You know, outside of New York and in the sort of like, you know, hip dining scene, it was kind of like, I didn't know.
Right.
Yeah. But it opened all these doors. So people started saying, hey, why don't you come to New York and do this dinner? I was like, really? You're going to fly me to New York and like, I'm going to go to the James Beard House and do a dinner. That's amazing. And, you know, after, you know, the third or fourth trip out here, people who I really respected would say, so when are you opening in New York? You'd kill it here. And, you know, I had lived in New York for a while in 2003. I used to come here when I was a kid, and I've always liked New York. And I started thinking, well, when am I opening here? Why, you know, why not? Like, things are stable in Portland. This would be, like, really interesting and fun. I like a good challenge. And so, you know, I just started looking around. The reason we ended up in Red Hook was that, you know, A, I like the neighborhood, number one. B, the rents were great compared. Like, I remember visiting a broker in Manhattan. He's like, you don't want to go to Manhattan. You don't want to go to Brooklyn. There's no money over there. I was like, what? Have you been to Williamsburg lately?
Right.
You know? And he said, why don't you look at this place? You know, it's in the East Village. The rent's only $15,000 a month. And I'd be like, I was just like shocked because I'm from Portland. And
you're thinking $5,000 a month or $7,000,
yes,
a month.
Yes, you know, or less, you know. So, you know, I started looking around and I saw, you know, this amazing space on the Columbia Waterfront District. And the rent was like not even close to that. It was much, much cheaper. And there was a backyard and I could grill there and stuff because you're not in the middle of Manhattan where everybody would, you know, come and have your scalp if you're belching out, you know, wood smoke.
Because it's a pretty small indoor space with a really big garden.
Exactly. That was the original restaurant. So that was what I just walked in and I was just like, this is it. You know those feelings when you walk into like you're looking for an apartment or whatever it is you're looking for. You're just like, yeah, this is it.
Like, what's next?
Next, we are, me and JJ are just finishing up the next book, which is on, it's called Pok Pok, the Drinking Food of Thailand. And this is Ahangap Kham, which is a very, you know, important part of Thai cuisine. It's a lot of fun. So we're doing that. We just opened another restaurant in Portland in Northwest neighborhood. It's going well.
It's called Pok Pok NW, right?
Yeah, Pok Pok Northwest, so Northwest neighborhood.
And you have something at the Portland airport?
We did. We had a little cart called Pok Pok Wing, which we turned into a brick and mortar earlier this year. Right, you know, we opened right in January or something like that.
Got
and,
it.
So that's going along pretty good. You know, what's next is just keep on doing what I do.
So who's at your last supper? No family allowed. You have a lot of passion. So I'm dying to hear the answer.
Well, there's passion and there's also personality. So, I think the first person that pops into mind is Willie Nelson. What a fantastic character.
Amazing.
You know, just packed with knowledge and skill, and he's always just done it his way.
And right. And he will do it his way, stoned, on the road, until he's no longer on this earth.
Right. And, you know, just that would be an amazing thing to have him at the table. I think that probably I would love Alex Chilton to come back from the dead.
Alex Chilton, the leader of the Box Tops.
And big star, just also just kind of a crazy but like incredibly original thinker who would only do what he wanted to
do. Yeah, and the Replacements wrote a song about him.
Exactly, yeah.
Which I love.
So we're hitting musicians so far.
That's okay. We can. I thought we would, but, you know, we should diversify.
But living, I think my friend David Thompson, who is, you know, I don't know, do you know David Thompson?
Sure, yeah. he is the Thai cookbook scholar, chef restaurateur.
Yeah, David is one of the most fun and interesting and sort of knowledgeable people I know. Just not just food, but in general.
Sure,
David Thompson could be there.
There has to be some women.
I'm going to end up in the musician thing again. Patti Smith,
right?
Patti Smith, like just this fierce. Like poet, punk, you know, maverick, amazing, and continues to mature and do really cool, interesting things.
Fascinating. Yeah, fascinating. All right, one more woman.
Okay, one more woman. Let's see. You know who – there was a person who really got to me early on, and that was Paula Wolfert, the woman who did couscous and other good foods.
Who is suffering from dementia, and it's a tragic story. And
yeah, I've read about that. And Paula Wolfert, I remember buying, like somehow I was at, I think it was at Powell's Books in Portland, you know, when, you know, years and years and years ago. And I saw this book about Moroccan cooking, I yanked it off the shelf, and I started reading it. It was so incredibly detailed and uncompromising, and it was like, if you're going to make bastilla, you have to make the pastry. Here's how you do it. It was a super intense book.
And Paula Wolfert was and is amazing and is underappreciated by the generations of people that grew up on the Food Network.
Yes. No, this was somebody who really like went there, lived there.
Yes,
it.
And I could see why you would relate to her so much. She was a little more scholarly than you.
Way.
But she would be a good person to have at the table for sure. What are you going to eat?
When we eat?
Yeah, when you finally sit down.
Well, I'm you know, screw
you don't
up.
Have to cook.
I don't care about what they want to eat. Okay. They're going to eat what I want to eat, basically.
All right.
Yeah.
All right.
I want to eat lab, Northern Thai minced meat salad, and I want to eat nem prick, a chili paste, and I want to eat sticky rice, and I want to have a big giant pile of freshly gathered wild herbs and greens and leaves and stuff like that. I mean, that this is like that dish and that way of eating is so you know, dear to me that I think that's what I would want to do.
Yeah. Got it. What do you cook when you come home and there's not much in the house to eat?
Nothing. I don't cook. At home. You know, that's the true honest thing is that, well, it depends on what home you're talking about.
Right. Because you have three homes.
Yeah. So I live in Portland. I have a house in Portland. I have an apartment here in New York. And then I have a house in Chiang Mai with my girlfriend, Gung. And so when people say that, like, to me, I automatically think of Chiang Mai. That's the place where I have, like, a home life. The cats are running around the yard. We've got a garden out in the back. You know, I've got my outdoor kitchen there. We eat, like, surprisingly simply. One of our favorite things to eat is we'll go in the garden and pick kanawan, which is like a sweet kind of bolted type of Chinese broccoli. And we'll just kind of, you know, peel that up a little bit, chop it, and get a little bit of pork belly and some chilies and garlic and oyster sauce and fish sauce and soy sauce and just do a quick stir fry with the vegetables.
That sounds awesome.
It's soul food. It's delicious. It's.
Well, I always think of your food as soul food, though.
I think it's very much folk. It's folk food for sure. So that with some really nice mountain, we call cao doi, which is mountain rice. It's like a unhulled type of plain rice, and then maybe we'll do like a salad of fried eggs or something like that, or a nam prick, tadang, which is it's kind of like the Thai red eye gravy,
right?
So it's like dry chilies and fermented and dried fish that's grilled, some garlic shallots, and you just pound it all into this really intense paste, and you eat it with sticky rice.
Sounds awesome. Yeah. So, do you have a guilty pleasure, like when you're in? And you're in Portland or in Chiang Mai or in Brooklyn. Like, is there like something that, you know, you just, even though you know it's bad for you?
No, I don't mix guilt and pleasure. It's pleasure and guilt are two separate things.
So right.
For the most part, I really try to eat healthy, but I, you know, if there's a donut sitting right there, I just pick it up and eat it.
Right. And you wouldn't think about it.
I wouldn't even think about it because I love, you know, I have a sweet tooth and I love eating donuts. I like ice cream. I can eat gallons of it. I just have to kind of like meter myself because when you get a little older, your metabolism doesn't work as quickly and, you know, does you more harm than good.
So who's the one person that you would love to sit down with and have a one-on-one lunch just to see how their mind works?
This is going to go right back to music for me. Music is an underlying passion that I don't really go to shows anymore. I don't have time. I don't buy tons of new music or anything like that. But I'm really like I love music, and Prince to me was such a fascinating character. Just like very, very singular.
Sure.
Like more talent in his little finger than most people have in their entire bloodline.
And, right.
Like from the outside, mysterious, interesting person. And by all accounts, a difficult person to talk to.
You know who on Special Sauce told us about cooking for Prince is Alex Guarnaschelli.
Oh.
He loved Alex's food so much that he told her that you are officially a member of the new power generation.
Wow. Wow, that's amazing.
Does it get any better than that?
Not much.
All right. You know, you talked about music, and I ignored the obvious question of, like, what instrument do you play?
Well, along with the hippie upbringing, my parents were also old-timey musicians. So, you know, I grew up around my dad was a fiddle player and a banjo player. My mom's a guitar player and a fiddle player. And my stepfather's an accordion player – or sorry, a concertina player and a storyteller. So I was surrounded by, you know, Appalachian and British Isles folk music my whole life, including my friend Ethan that we talked about last week.
He was
very much in the same milieu. So I grew up, you know, the first instrument I picked up was a banjo, and I learned how to clawhammer banjo, five-string banjo, and then I moved on to guitar and had, you know, a couple of disastrous attempts at learning from my mom. So I started playing guitar, and then I got into rock and blues and stuff, and then I've played guitar since I was 15, so what is that? That's embarrassingly long, like 38 years or something, and I'm still crap. But I started in the rock band that I played in first. The bass player didn't show up for practice.
So you became a bass player?
Yeah, I went downstairs and I picked up the bass and I started playing. And I was like, this is it. This is what, you know, this is what I've been looking for.
Like, this is what I was put on this earth to play.
Well, you know, I wouldn't say it's a God-given thing, but, you know, it was like I connected with it.
Right.
The connection between the melody and the rhythm, the bass player is that bridge. And you can play something very simple that has a lot of impact. So you can be really creative. You can be really busy like Paul McCartney, or you could be like the dude in AC/DC or the Ramones, you know, just play one note every chord. So to me, the bass was what really got to me, but it's not really an instrument that you can play by yourself, so, you know, unless you just – because it just doesn't make any sense. You don't have those two things to connect.
Well, what about that bass line on Bad Luck by Harold Melvin and Boone?
Yeah, but try sitting in your living room and just playing that over and over again. No fun. So guitar still is – I would have to say is still my primary instrument.
Right.
You know, it's the thing that I keep going back to.
Cool. So it's just been declared Andy Ricker Day all over America. What's happening all over the country?
Everybody's sleeping in.
Sleeping in.
Yeah. And then they're going to get a really good coffee.
Okay.
Yeah.
Maybe with a donut.
Yeah, donut if you want.
Okay.
Bagel if you can find one that isn't frozen and reheated.
Right.
I don't know. I don't know. In an ideal world, everybody would, you know, myself included, would have time to sit and read a book for a while.
Mm-hmm.
That would be kind of nice.
And would they be eating Thai food?
They might be eating Thai food, but they'd probably be playing with a cat or two.
Okay. How many cats do you have?
Three.
Three?
Three, yeah.
What are their names?
Nampu, Yindi, and Jamuk.
Those are my cat's names.
Get out of here. You've got a cat named... Crab paste, welcome, and nose.
Yes.
That's amazing.
How did you know? What a coincidence. Yeah. All right. Well, thank you so much for sharing your special sauce with us, fish or otherwise, Andy Ricker. We appreciate you coming. And no matter where you live, you owe it to yourself to pick up a copy of Andy's amazing Pock Pock book. And if you do find yourself in Portland, eat at one of Andy's five restaurants, Pock Pock Northwest, Pock Pock Noi, Pock Pock Wing, and Pock Pock PDX, or the Whiskey Lounge, right?
Whiskey Soda Lounge.
Whiskey Soda Lounge. And if you find yourself in New York, of course, eat at the Pock Pock in Brooklyn. So long, Serious Eaters. Thank you again, Andy. It's really been a pleasure.
Yindi hapum.
I assume that's thank you in Thai. And we'll see you next time, Serious Eaters.